Hi, team. We're the Monkees.
Did you tell them about the TV show yet, Mike?
No, man. I was going to sneak it in. You got to be very subtle about these things.
You're going to tell them that we'll be on NBC TV starting September 12th at 7:30 p.m. in colors?
Cool it. What's more fun than a barrel full of monkeys?
Gosh, a Rooney, Mike. I don't know. What is more fun than a barrel full of monkeys?
A train full of monkeys. Dig. KHJ's chartered the last train to Clarksville, and they're going to take hundreds of lucky listeners on a trip September the 11th.
Bro.
Yeah, it's going to be a blast. The KHJ happening to wrap up the summer of 66.
And us monkeys want to meet you at the station in Clarksville.
Yeah, each of us will give away a color TV set.
So enter now. All you do is send a postcard to Monkey Trip, Box 38130, Hollywood. Starting Tuesday morning, the bus jocks draw a winner every hour, and each winner gets to bring a friend.
Mail your card in and ride with the monkeys.
On the last train to Clarksville.
The Beatles and the Monkees together as one right here. And Breakfast with the Beatles, and we want to welcome to the Breakfast with the Beatles studios one of the great voices of the 60s, still going strong this summer on the Happy Together Tour. Welcome, the great Mickey Dolenz. Mickey! Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you.
Fresh off the stage with Ringo Starr last night at the theater.
Yes. Yes. That was wonderful. Well, obviously, I'm a huge fan. And we went to the show and invited us all up there. Some of my old time great buddies, Steve Lukather, I've known for years, Todd Rundgren. What a great show.
And how about Ringo? He looks fantastic, doesn't he?
Well, he always does. He always does, and he's such a, you know, such a wonderful, wonderful person to be around, and such a positive energy, and that's, you know, the show was just such an uplifting, great show.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. So, Mickey, one thing I always noticed about the Monkees was that all the top-level heavy pop stars always dug the Monkees, always liked to hang out with you guys, and that's an interesting thing, because, you know, the Monkees are, depends who you talk to, you know, classified in a different space, you know. We put you up there with the Beatles and the Stones, my friends. But you know how people perceive the Monkees. But always the rock stars, you know, whether it was Jimi Hendrix or Neil Young or the Beatles, they were always hanging out.
Well,
with you guys.
I think that you know.
Why is that, Mickey?
So I think that it's because at that time, there were those that got it, and there were those that didn't get it.
Right.
There were some people in the music business and the television business, but mostly the music business, that just didn't get what it was about, the Monkees. But there were those that did. Frank Zappa is a classic example who came on the show. He was a big fan. It was unusual at the time to have that sort of convergence. Very seldom did it happen. There was, you know, Paul Peterson had a record, one record, or somebody would come out, some TV star would come out with a record. But to have that concerted sort of assault on the American consumer, and to converge all these industries, the radio record industry, the radio industry, and the television industry, had not yet really happened. The radio industry was a very tight, closed shop,
right.
You know, with a lot of stuff going on under the table and behind closed doors. And all of a sudden, here comes this television show about this band and these songs written by incredible songwriters, Carole King and Neil Diamond and Harry Nilsson. And what happened essentially is that because of the television show being on every Monday night and doing very well, and as a sales tool for the records, the rack drivers and the distributors and the record industry, which was very, very powerful, they had no choice. They had to play those songs. They were forced into playing those songs, and they didn't like being forced into doing anything, some of those guys. And there was resentment at that level. But like you say, you know, Frank Zappa, the Beatles, John Lennon was the first one to say, I like the Monkees, I like the Marx Brothers.
Right.
Which is a much terrible accent, I'm sorry. But, but he was the first, we were screening Marx Brothers movies when we were doing the show, because you got to remember, the Monkees was not a band. It was a television show about a band that wanted to be the Beatles. And on the show, we were never successful. we were always struggling for that success, and that's what I think everybody recognized.
You guys
recognized.
Were always going to auditions with, you know, the Jolly yeah. Green Giants and stuff.
We were trying to be famous, and that was one of the things I think endeared it to people. But the Beatles and other people, they got that dynamic. They got right. what that was about. The closest thing that's come along since the Monkees I've seen is Glee, mm-hmm. which is a show about a Glee club.
Right.
You know, right. and it's cast by really talented people that can sing and dance. I've heard they've gone on the road, actually, the people of Glee. But it wasn't a real Glee club.
I got it.
But now, has it become one? Because they go on the road. So it's an interesting little story.
So, Mickey, you've had a number of Beatle encounters during your Monkee days and after. Tell us a Beatle story you've never told anyone before. Right now, Mickey, we want an exclusive.
Well, I can't mix
kidding.
Company.
Oh, yes, you can.
No. I don't think there is one that I haven't told, you know, because...
Which one do you really got down pat that you can, you know, tell us right now?
Well, one of my favorite ones is when I first went to England on a press junket, and some publicist put together the Monkee Meets Beatle, you know, thing for the newspapers.
Right.
It was Kapow, Monkee Meets Beatle, because there was all this nonsense, you know, competition and this, you know, great debate about the Monkees versus the Beatles, which really didn't exist. Their fans were an entirely different generation than right. Monkee fans. By the time the Monkees came along, Beatles were already into way, way older crowds, and, you know, especially at that age, the difference between 10 and 18 is huge at that age. And our fans were 10 and 12 years old. Beatle fans by then were 18, 20. I was a Beatle fan. I was 20, 22 years old. And
right.
So it's a huge difference. But they still, you know, the press, the gutter press, they want to make a big deal out of it. Anyway, Paul invited me over to his house in Maidavale, and we had just him and I, we had dinner, and I was a photographer there, and they took a couple of pictures, and we just hung out, and I was talking to him about this just like a year or two ago when he was rehearsing for Chowchilla. We were talking about that night because we, you know, just a wonderful evening, and then he invited me to a session for a new album they were doing called Sergeant Something. What? I don't know whatever happened to that album. It was really good. I got to ask.
They never whatever? Followed up and finished
no,
it.
No, man, you know, sometimes you just never know. And so, of course, I was thrilled and you know, to be invited. And I'm trying to be so cool, too. And I got my autograph book in, you know, my back pocket.
That's
and I'm
cool.
I'm trying to be cool with Paul, you know. Well, yeah, man, it's really far out, man. Cool, yeah. So I get dressed up to go to this session. And I don't know what I was expecting, you know, some psycho jello Beatle Fest love-in freak-out, you know, event. So I dress accordingly in my paisley bell-bottoms and my tie-dyed underwear and my little glasses and my hair.
Wait a minute,
and
you had tie-dyed underwear? You had tie-dyed underwear?
Oh, of course. I looked like a cross between Ronald McDonald and Charlie Manson.
Nice.
And I show up, you know, three sheets to the wind in the middle of the day. It's like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 60s. Expecting this massive event. And limo drops me off at Abbey Road Studios. And I walk in. It looks like my high school gymnasium. It's fluorescent lighting. Nobody there, just the four guys in jeans and t-shirts sitting in folding chairs. And they're just playing. Chunk, 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 chunk. And I'm like standing there like looking like a total idiot going, where are the girls? And John Lennon looks up at me and he says, hey, Monkee Man. That's what he called me, Monkee Man. You want to hear what we're working on? And I'm like trying to be so cool. Yeah, far out, John. Yeah, cool. Yeah, cool, man. And he points up to George Martin, who's up in the booth. George, it's the middle of the day, you know. And George Martin is wearing a three-piece suit because they had to. All the engineers yeah. and people had to wear full, you know, suits and ties. And so George Martin's up there wearing a three-piece suit, and he hits the button on a four-track tape recorder, and this is what I hear.
Heading for home, you start to roam, then you're in town.
So this is what you hear. You hear
yeah.
good morning, right?
Yeah.
And real quick, because we're going to get to one of the reasons you're here, because you got a new album coming out yeah. in September with some fab covers on it. But real quick, that song ended up in an episode of the Monkees.
Well,
didn't
obviously,
it?
Yeah, I was burned into my, you know, just eternally etched into my neural pathways, you know, being there
heavy
at that session. And I got back to the States, and I was directing. I'd written and directed an episode of the Monkees, and there was a scene at the beginning where we were. It's in the morning. We're supposed to wake up to an alarm, and I said, "Oh man, it'd be so cool if there's like this Rube Goldberg device that plays the Beatle album, and that's the song that wakes us up in the morning. Isn't that cool?" I said, "Get that song for the show.
Yeah, get that Beatles song."
And I don't remember how it happened. I don't remember if I called somebody at Apple, or you know, I could have called Paul, I don't remember, or the producers called somebody,
right.
And lo and behold, for nothing, for free, they said, "Oh yeah, the Monkees can use the song." So on that episode, it's called "Mija Kocha, the Frodus Caper." That song, and to my knowledge, especially back then, you'd never heard Beatles stuff on
anything. You never
heard
a Beatles song on television.
Never on TV or films or anything like that. So, like I say, I mean, the song just stuck with me for years and years. And I was on stage in the 90s, and I would actually tell that story and then play the song and sing the song. I'd love to talk a little bit about the new album, because I'm very, very proud of it.
Well, tell us the name of it.
It's called Remember, and the title song is the Remember by Harry Nilsson, because I was there when he wrote a lot of stuff, but I remember that tune very, very well. And it's sort of this little, an audio scrapbook, if you will, of my life and of the songs and of the tunes, some I wrote, some I didn't, that had some sort of an influence on me, had an impact. Obviously, Good Morning did. And there's some others. I'll play a couple of others. Just, you know, songs that just stuck with me for years and years. Like, for instance, I do a version of the song that was my audition piece for the Monkees, which was Johnny Be Good. But rather than do just covers of the original, I tend to, you know, come up with some a more unusual, I'd like to think, unusual and interesting arrangement and feel, let's say. It, much in the same way that I love the Joe Cocker covers of the Beatle tunes that he did.
Because he makes them his own.
Made him his own, you know, absolutely. In turn, that was tone, arrangement, just the whole feel. And in the case of A Good Morning, Good Morning, over the years, I would start playing it because it was just burned into my brain so deeply. And I started playing it on acoustic guitar, because I play mainly acoustic guitar and always did. And I just started messing about with the arrangement and actually the time signatures. And whereas in the original, the verses are in fours and then it goes into triplets for the choruses, I switched it around. And I don't know how it happened or when it happened, probably 2 o'clock in the morning after a half a bottle of rosé or something. And I just came up with arrangement. And then when I went to my producer, David Harris, this wonderful, wonderful producer, whose idea basically it was to get me to do this album, he just badgered me into it after years. He says, "You really gotta lay some of this stuff down, some of these arrangements, some of these covers." And this is one of the things that he fell in love with. And I just played it to him on my acoustic guitar. And this is the first track, I believe. This is gonna be, I don't know where Rob went.
Rob Christie, where
Rob
are you,
Christie?
Record company guy?
I believe this is going to be the first cut on the album.
We're going to spin it for you right now. Mickey Dolenz doing the Beatles, and that's Mickey on acoustic.
In Little Stevens' Underground Garage.
Good morning.
Mickey Dolenz doing the Beatles. Good morning, good morning. Was that a world premiere, Mickey, right there?
It was. As I was listening, I was going, "Whoa, this is the first time anybody anywhere has ever heard that."
I like the flute solo.
I got to give a shout out to the musicians. I mean, besides David Harris, like I say, the producer and arranger of the album, Bob Birch on bass from Elton John's band, Phil Kagi, a Nashville guitar player, is one of the greatest guitar players, Alex Acuna on percussion. It just came out so cool. Phil plays the acoustic electric guitar on that.
Great sounding track. We're hanging with Mickey Dolenz. We're going to take a quick break. Stick around. My name is Chris Carter.
The management at Cold Gems Records has asked me to explain something.
Which is no big surprise, because people are always asking their kids to explain everything.
Hey, hey, mercy woman plays a song and no one listens. I need help, I'm falling again. Listen to the band.
They want to bring us out all the time, to get us to talk, to tell them what we think, so they can tell us why we're wrong. But for us, our music says it all. Like the Monkees in their new album, The Monkees Present.
There's a smile on the wind as it touches my face and starts to erase all the gloom.
Their music is like we are. It's hard to say why you like it, except the music talks to you instead of expecting you to talk to it. Get The Monkees Present on Coal Gems, records and Stereo 8 cartridge tape. It's music that talks to you.
Ah, how nice. We're hanging with Mickey Dolenz in Little Steven's Underground Garage. So, Mickey, tell us about all those fabulous songwriters you used to work with in the Monkees.
Yeah, well, we had those great songwriters from the Brill Building, you know, that were assigned. I remember meeting Carole King, and somebody said, this is Carole King, she's going to be writing songs for you. I was like, okay, hi, Carole. You know, we had these incredible songwriters, and it starts with the material as anything else. I'd like to think that I had something to do with it, you know, in the singing and the playing, but when you start with material of that quality, you know.
So, Mickey, you were a pretty hip guy when you auditioned for the Monkees. You knew the Beatles and the Stones were the top two bands, you know, on the scene. What went through your head at the end of 1967 when you outsold both the Beatles and the Stones in America? I mean, that must
have somebody actually had to tell me that.
Freaked you guys out.
You know, we had, as you know the story, we had little or no control over what was happening in the music.
Right.
End of it. We didn't control the records that were done or released or the album or the cover or the photo of the artwork, nothing. And then eventually we had a palace revolt and we fixed that. But I, for one, had very little idea what was going on, you know. I remember Tommy Boyce, the late, great, wonderful Tommy Boyce, said to me one day, Mickey, you have 3 songs in the top 10 in Cashbox. And I said, what's Cashbox? Because I'd come out.
So you weren't that hip then, Mickey.
Well,
I'm sorry. I thought you were.
I was, you know, I'd come out of television and film. I had a series when I was a kid called Circus Boy. And my parents were actors and singers. But I had come out of the Los Angeles, you know, television and film industry. I played classical guitar. Spanish guitar was my first instrument. My dad got me playing. It's still my instrument of choice today. I got into folk music because I found out girls liked Kingston Trio better than Segovia and started playing like Tom Dooley.
Oh, those Kingston Trio fans.
Yeah, right. And then it morphed into rock and roll. And I was in rock and roll cover bands as a singer just before the Monkee auditions, and I was singing, doing open mic stuff around town, but doing Barrett Strong, Money, and doing Van Morrison, or doing my first party piece was House of the Rising Sun, you know, Eric Burdon. So that was the direction I was going in.
Right.
People have often asked me, would you have been a Monkee fan if you weren't one of the Monkees? And no, I wouldn't. You know, I wasn't a 10-year-old little girl. I was a 20, 22-year-old guy, and I was listening to,
more heady stuff.
Well, yeah. Like I say, I was a big fan. Chuck Berry and Little Richard and rock and roll and Fats Domino and then the Stones and the Beatles, and then that's what I was listening to. But I was cast to play this, you know, rock and roll drummer in this TV show, wacky rock and roll drummer singing, you know, these great pop tunes.
But you actually outsold your heroes. I mean, that must have been
that was
a lot
embarrassing.
To wrap your
I think
head
it's
around.
More than anything.
And then,
it was
and
just
then,
embarrassing.
Like, the next year, 1968. You know, it was just a drastic change where you guys are, boom, you're not on TV anymore the next year. And, you know, you make this film, which is kind of the Monkees version of Magical Mystery Tour, which became Head.
Yeah.
And that's another thing I want to ask you. Like, over the years, this film, Head, has become this, you know, cult classic. People put it in their top 10 movies of all time with, you know, Casablanca and, you know, The Wizard of Oz and Head. And you see that and you go, interesting. What were your thoughts when you made it? And now what are your thoughts, you know, all these years later at the way it's kind of held up and has this odd cult following. People go to movie theaters to see if there's.
It's a long story. I don't know how involved you want me to get. If you know, just do this. Wiggle your finger.
Okay.
If I'm boring you, when they came to us, Bob Rafelson, who created and produced and directed the Monkees, came and introduced us to this guy named Jack Nicholson, who was a B movie actor at the time, and
right.
he wanted to be a writer, and said we want to do a Monkee movie. And I remember being asked what kind of movie, and I. The general consensus was that we did not want to do a 90-minute version of one of the episodes, that we had a chance to spread our wings a little bit. And I remember liking that idea, just the idea of that, because we could get away with stuff in a film that we never could get away with under the restrictions and the censors of NBC. So Jack started hanging out with us, and we talked, and we went away and had these script meetings, and we came back, and we talked and went back and forth, and he came over to my house, everybody's house, and hung out. And he and Bob went away and crafted this script called Head, which originally, by the way, was called Changes. It wasn't called Head. But the story goes they named it Head because the second movie they made, they wanted to be able to say from the producers that gave you Head.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if that's urban myth or not. Anyway, we made the movie. I'm very proud of my work in the movie. You know, there's some real acting, a little sometimes, you know. And it wasn't a wacky episode of The Monkees. It was very strange. I'm still not sure what it's about to this day. But, you know, whenever I talk about it and do little symposiums and people ask, it was a deconstruction. But it wasn't just a deconstruction of The Monkees. This was Bob Rafelson, Bert Schneider, Jet Nicholson, Dennis Hopper's in the movie, Peter Fonda. This was the beginning of that Raging Bull, Easy Rider. I mean, the producers of the Monkees took the Monkee money and made Easy Rider with the money. Because they were the beginning, they were the young bucks, and this was the beginning of the independent film industry in this city. It didn't exist before this.
The Monkees hanging with the real hip, cool people, even in the film world. Again, you guys attracted that. It's an interesting thing.
Well, these people got it. They got what it was all about. And we made that movie, and I still like it. There's parts of it that I'm not sure, you know, what it's about myself.
But the theme song,
Quentin Tarantino keeps telling me what
how
it's about.
How great it is. He explains it to you.
He explains it to me. It was a deconstruction of the Monkees, but also of Hollywood. I don't know if you remember seeing the film, but there's that one scene where it's a Western scene, Terry Garr's in it. And,
sure.
And it's we're in Calvi outfits, and I burst through the backdrop at the back of the set and say to Bob, I'm finished. I'm fed up with all this crap. I'm out of here.
Broken arrow.
Well, that's symbolic. That was, in symbolism of breaking out of the mold, out of the Hollywood major studio mold. And it, like I say, it was this symbolic deconstruction of the Hollywood victimateur, you know, representing old Hollywood.
Big Victor.
Yeah.
And the theme song, one of Carole King's best songs ever. When did you first hear that song, and what did you think? Did you think that's a keeper?
I always liked all of her stuff. The last
album
I did
a special song.
I'm telling you, I don't remember when I first heard it. It would have been at her house or at my house, and she'd have brought over, or we'd have routined it, I guess, on the piano.
We're talking about the Porpoise song.
The Porpoise.
Can we play the Porpoise song?
I'd love to.
Do I have your permission?
Play that. It's one of my favorite songs and one of my favorite vocals. We did it a year ago on the Monkee Tour, and it was just wonderful.
Let's spin it right now. Title track, the theme from the Monkees film Head on Breakfast with the Monkees.
The Beatles! Breakfast with the Beatles and girl! Oh, yeah, girl, here we are with Chris Carter and Mickey Dolenz.
Thank you, Mickey. That was great. I'm glad I asked you to do that.
That's my DJ. I can't help it. I get in front of a mic and I just start talking like that.
Coming at you on a Sunday morning with Mickey Dolenz and Ethan. Russell's got a brand new book out called Hey, An American Story. So, Mickey, you want to take a phone call real quick?
Yeah, please, sure.
All right, line two, Mark.
Fred.
Is it
hey,
Fred?
Hi, Mickey. Yeah, hi, Mickey. How you doing?
Hi.
Hey, a big fan of yours, and I was going to ask you one quick question, but I got to say one thing.
Yeah?
I'm a believer is what maybe one of the top five great records of all time. I mean, the song, your performance, the hooks, you've got the organ, which was like state of the art, like that fruity organ sound. You heard about Red River Ball back in the day. And then that guitar lick, and was that Glenn Campbell?
Could have been.
Yeah.
That's a long time ago. Well, it could have been, absolutely, yeah.
It's a perfect record, is what I'm saying.
Well, thank you.
It's perfect. But anyway, what I was going to ask you about is I read a story years ago about a little jam session that Jimi Hendrix and Stephen Stills had in a hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
And you got in there and started playing on a guitar case.
Mm-hmm.
Does that ring a bell? Could you?
Yes, it's true story, yeah. Yeah, well, Jimmy was our opening act, as you probably know, for 6-8 gigs on the first tour. And Stephen was a friend, and, he'd become a friend of everybody, and he joined us on tour. We had a private plane, so we would just pick people up and fly them around the country. And, of course, on tour like that, most of the time you spend in the hotel room because you can't go outside. So we often would have little jams. I'm told I had a great time. We were sitting just jamming in the hotel room, and the story goes that I was playing along, and then I just stopped for some reason, and everybody else stopped, and they said to me, "Why did you stop?" And I said, "I didn't think anyone was listening."
He stopped that jam with Hendrix.
Yeah, just a jam buster. My wife just posted a picture I found of us sitting in a hotel room.
Yeah, I just saw that on the
with
Facebook.
Jimmy and playing guitar, and Mike sitting there, and Peter sitting there. Yeah.
There you go. Is that a good answer to your question?
That's a great answer. And let me add this. Good morning, Mickey. That's a great record. I'm going to get it. It is really, really good.
Look, well, you sold a record.
I sold one. There's one, honey. It's called Remember. It's out September 25th. We're going to be playing the single. I got a story about the single that we're going to be releasing, and I'm really proud of this album. I can't talk enough about it. Some of the great musicians I got on this album: John Cowsill and
if that's his real name.
Yeah.
Is this coming out on vinyl too, Mickey, or no? You put a little vinyl out, Rob Christie.
I don't know. You're going to have to be.
I think we should all vote on it.
Maybe at least
right
a couple.
Make at least five copies
on
vinyl.
For us. Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break. Come back. Hear a track from the above-mentioned Remember by Mickey Dolenz. Don't go anywhere.
Look up. Look down. Look out. Here come the monkeys. Mickey, David, Mike, Peter, and Head. That's right. Head. Head has everything. Including Victor Mature, Annette Funicello, Sonny Liston, and other incredible surprises. What is Head? Head is the most extraordinary Western. Comedy, love story, mystery, drama, musical, documentary, satire, ever filmed. And that's putting it mildly. Head for general audiences.
Hey, hey, this is Davy Jones of the Monkees, and you're in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Psychedelic! The colors!
If you can't tell, we're hanging with Mickey Dolenz on Breakfast with the Beatles from the second best album of the year, 1967, The Monkees, Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, and Jones LTD, Daily Nightly. Heavy, baby. And that's you on the Moog synthesizer?
Yeah, that was the Moog synthesizer. It was, to be honest, it was a very, very difficult instrument to play, the original ones, because they were monophonic. You could only play one note at a time. That note could sound like anything in the universe, but it was only one note, so I spent most of the time doing flying saucer sounds.
And it only took batteries, that thing, I heard. Is that true?
No, mine plugged in. No, right. Oh, it was very complicated to create the sounds and to keep it in tune and stuff like that.
But, and never before in a rock recording had we heard that
before.
That
was the first, if I'm not mistaken.
Mickey Dolenz, groundbreaker.
I remember once Tom Cruise told me never to drop names, but...
Who?
But John was over at the house. John Lennon was at the house one night for a big party, and I had the Moog there, and he got quite fascinated by it. And he sat there for hours and hours doing flying saucer sounds.
Say that again, Mickey. I had a party, and John Lennon was there. See, just that alone, is most people can't say that.
Oh, that was a great party, actually, because Brian Wilson showed up. And that was during the Sandbox period. And now, I know Brian quite well. And
did he bring his own sand, or do you have to provide it when he comes to the party?
No, but he came. We heard he was going to come, but I didn't believe it because he hadn't been out of the house for a long, long time. But John was in town. It was the beginning of the weekend, and the long weekend. And Harry, of course, Nielsen was a very dear friend of mine. And so everybody came over to my house, and sure enough, a limo pulls up, and Brian Wilson gets out in the bathrobe and the thongs, the beach slippers, with his minor at the time, and he comes in, and you know, he was okay. He was obviously having some problems, but I had a little recording studio downstairs just for fun, you know, and everybody sat down, started jamming, and Brian started playing.
Proud Mary?
No, some Beach Boy thing. Okay. But it was the new thing he was working on, you know. But it was a typical 8-bar, you know. California surfing, and a bond is on the dune. California surfing, on the bond down the dunes. And everybody picks up. John has a guitar.
So John Lennon is jamming with Brian Wilson.
Yeah, John's playing guitar, and Harry Nilsson picked up something. Somebody playing, you know. I sat on the drums and went cha-ching, cha-ching. And we just jammed along, but it's over and over again. California. And this goes on for like, you know, minutes, and then it seems like an hour. And everybody's looking at each other, and finally John says, Brian, go to the friggin' bridge.
And Brian left to find a bridge.
Yeah, right.
We haven't brought this up, obviously, yet. Our thoughts went out to the loss of Davy Jones. I know that was tough for all you guys,
but
what's the future for the Monkees? I mean, is there anything in the horizon?
You never know. I've learned never to say never with the Monkees. It was a big shock, just right out of the blue. And, there was no telltale signs, you know, just a shock. And I'm not sure I'm still over it, you know. I mean, he was... great guy. We were very close. We, you know, had similar backgrounds in the business, child stars and stuff like that. And then we lived not far from each other. We had kids about the same time, got married about the same time. And so, yeah, we were very close. I explain it just simplest way to say it is just like having a brother, a sibling. You know, that's the closest thing. I mean, I knew him for 45 years. I probably spent more time with him than I did some of my siblings, you know, over the years. So that's kind of the way that I describe it. It was just terrible.
And speaking of the Monkees, you cover a Monkee song on the new Remember album, which is coming out when, Rob Christie? September?
September 25th.
September 25th, Mickey Dolenz. Remember that date.
Yeah, I actually cover a couple. I cover the Johnny Be Good, which was my audition piece for the Monkees. And again, a very unusual sort of arrangement. And I also cover again Sometime in the Morning, which I've actually even covered before, another Carole King tune.
You keep covering.
That's my Layla. I think that one is going to be my Layla. But the one I'd love you to play a bit of is going to be our single. This is going to be the, if there is such a thing anymore. I mean, I don't even know what you call it now. You can't say album. You can't say
CD. It's the first song offered.
It's a digital dump.
Right.
digital. And you can get it on my face and your face and everybody's face. I don't even know how that works anymore there. But the whole record thing and the album, it's ridiculous. And I also do I'm a Believer, a country version of I'm a Believer, because you mentioned I'm a Believer. But when I was in England, like, you know, and the whole Beatle thing, they threw us a party, and the next day I was recovering. And I was recovering from... from the party and sitting in my hotel room, and there was kids out screaming on the sidewalks, and I started noodling, and I hadn't written a whole lot myself, and I started noodling on a guitar and came up with a little bit of a stream of consciousness sort of, you know, song about my adventures in London, you know, the first time I'd been there and meeting the girl that was going to eventually become my wife and the fans and the kids and my friends and Mama Cass was there and the Beatles. And I wrote this song and I named it Randy Scouse Git, because that was I was watching TV and there was a show on English television called Till Death Do Us Part, which became All in the Family over here. And the father figure calls the young boy character a Randy Scouse Git. A Randy Scouse Git. And I just thought it was funny. I had no idea what it meant. I just thought, that's, you know, typical 60s. That's really a funny name. Yeah, cool, man. So I named it that. Well, months later, I'm back in the States, and the record company calls and says the English record company wants to release it as a single. I was like, wow, cool. And they said, but you have to give it an alternative title. I said, why? I said, because they won't call it that. It's rude.
Right.
And I said, well, why? And they said, well, it's rude. And I said, what does it mean? It turns out a Randy Scouse Git is a horny Liverpudlian putz.
Nice.
And so, and they said, you can't call it that. I said, okay, well, you need an alternate title. So in England, it's still to this day known as alternate title. It went up to number two and was only kept out by the Beatles.
Those darn Beatles again.
I don't remember what song, but it was...
So if you buy this in England, this new version, is it also called alternative title?
No.
That would have been
now
clever, Rob.
That would be clever. So anyway, when we decided to redo it, this is the great, great talent, genius of this guy, David Harris. He said, you should do Randy Scouse Git again. I said, well, I don't want to just cover the same song, cover it in the same way. He says, let me play around with it. And he did this on a number of songs on this album. He just, I don't know where it comes from.
Changed the arrangement drastically.
Well, it's more than the arrangement. Mm-hmm. It's you'll see. Well, if you're familiar with the first one, you notice.
They all
know.
Are you kidding? These people, they've had these records. They know these records by heart. Maybe.
Yeah. So this is going to be the single. This is the new improved version of a Randy Scouse Git.
She's a wonderful lady, and she's my, all mine.
Brand new music from Mickey Dolenz. I love that.
Thank you.
That gets applause, Mickey. That's
Thank
really
you.
Nice. Nice. Your voice sounds like 1968. It's like, you know, amazing. What do you do for your vocals? Do you exercises?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You once told me you went and saw Paul McCartney rehearsing. You were saying, he's not taking care of his voice right
now. No, I was scolding him. I know, I've tried to get him, well, there's others that have tried to get him to protect your voice, you know. It's tough when you're on the road, especially. And for me, you know, I learned a lesson, you know, 10 years ago when I started to lose my voice. And I was doing musical theater. I was doing Aida, the Elton John, Tim Rice musical. And it was 8 shows a week, but I had to hit some big notes, you know, full voice, not rock and roll kind of stuff, but that big... You know, and
wow.
Eight, and that can
you frightened engineer Mark over there.
I went off mic there for you a little bit. Well, and I went to a vocal coach here in Los Angeles, incredible vocal coach called Eric Vitro, and he saved.
If that's his real name,
it is. Yeah, and he saved me, you know, and taught me placement and how to breathe and how to protect it because, yeah, so now I do train because I do a lot of musical theater. I did, I just got back from England. I did Hairspray over there.
Yeah, right. You do a lot of that stage stuff.
Pippin I did, and I love doing it. Love doing the musical theater. And there, and you have to prepare yourself. You have to keep your chops up.
Well, that version of Randy Scouse Git was fantastic. We love it. From the forthcoming.
Horny Liverpudlian Putz.
Yes. I think you should have used that title just by itself. September 25th, remember Mickey Dolenz's latest. We're going to take a quick break. Back with more.
One, two. Man, they're the most. Man, they're the monkeys. Take the wildest ride of your life with the world's zaniest string quartet. Swing with the Monkees at 7:30, 6:30 Central Time.
So, Mickey, you're on tour with Flo and Eddie and the gang, the Happy Together Tour. When do you pick that back up? When do you guys go back on the road?
Wednesday.
Wednesday
I leave. I think I think I leave Wednesday.
What's it like on tour sharing catering with Flo and Eddie backstage? What's that like?
It's an interesting experience. Actually, it's so much fun traveling with these guys. Traveling stuff, you know, I tell people they pay me to travel. I sing for free. The traveling beats me up, but the show is really great. It's so much fun with Gary Puckett and the Grassroots and the Buckinghams and Flo and Eddie. And we're having a gas. It's a lot of fun.
Well, I'm glad you guys are out there because, you know, I was telling a couple of friends, in a few years, maybe, what, 10 years or so, everybody's going to be gone. Mick and Keith and, I mean, guys can't last forever. And when everybody goes, you know, I'm curious to see how much this music we all love from the 60s and 70s is going to last, if it will, you know, because nobody will be around to be pushing it. Paul's out there. He's got, you know, a press team and he's doing tours, and Roger Waters, all these guys, you know, are pushing their products. But once they're gone, I'm curious if the music we love is going to remain this digital world. Speaking of digital world,
next Sunday here on Breakfast with the Beatles, we'll be featuring the brand new digital only Beatles album, Tomorrow Never Knows. Mickey Dolenz, thank you so much for hanging with us here on a Sunday morning. Jackie DeShannon, thank you for this week in Beatle News. Little Steven Van Zandt, thank you, my brother, for allowing us each and every Sunday in your underground garage. I don't know how much time we have, so we're going to close out with some Beatles, some Monkees, some Beatles, some Monkees. See you next Sunday. My name is Chris Carter, and it's been a pleasure hanging with Mickey Dolenz.
We'd like to thank everybody for making it a wonderful stay. We'd like to thank the Rolling Stones for being a great group. We'd like to thank the Mamas and Papas for making it good. We'd like to thank Loving Spoonful for making it happy. But most of all, we'd like to thank the Beatles for starting it all up for us.
Oh, yeah.
And this concludes another edition of America's longest-running Beatles show, Breakfast with the Beatles. Chris will be back in the Underground Garage with a brand new show next Sunday. Same fab time, same fab station. And remember...
Hey.